Wakey, wakey. Figs and bakey.
It's time for an unbalanced breakfast with Matt and Catherine, a.k.a. Smart.
Hamburger, the cornerstone of any nutritious breakfast.
My boy says he can eat 50 eggs, he can eat 50 eggs.
Do you like apples?
I don't drink juice.
How about you, Sad Burns? You want some of this milk?
Bless his highly nutritious microwaveable macaroni and cheese dinner that people sold it on sale. Amen.
They've got the hottest takes on the hottest stories and trends in food, nutrition, and fitness.
Come on! Bread makes you fat.
Bread makes you fat?
I haven't had a carb since 2004.
Calories, that's a gluten. Fat, that's a gluten.
Yeah, it's got electrolytes.
Built protein combined with synthetic aminos, vitamins, and minerals. Everything the body needs.
I'm only eating foods with less than 30% calories from fat. It's 40%.
He read the squirrels were high in cholesterol.
We're about to find out what happens when a policy student and a science student interact.
And I also brought you some hydroponically grown goji berries with vegan barbecue sauce and some organic pumpkin chips.
Short answer, being vegan just makes you better than most people.
I happen to be a vegetarian.
You must have had vegetables fresher than that growing up on a farm, Greg.
Never trust a vegetarian.
Looks like meat's back on our menu.
The views and opinions expressed on this show are solely those of the participants and do not necessarily reflect those of WMFO, Tufts University, or the Friedman School of Nutrition.
Yes. Who's hungry?
And the people did feast upon the lambs and sloths and carp and anchovies and orangutans and breakfast cereals and fruit bats.
Good morning and welcome to an unbalanced breakfast here on WMFO 91.5 Medford, also streaming live on WMFO.org. And as the intro says, the show features myself, Matt, and Catherine, but Catherine is out this week. Instead, we have filling in for her is Kathleen.
Kathleen, morning, Kathleen. Catherine.
Basically the same.
I get called Catherine all the time.
So you're used to it. Well, that's good. Hopefully nobody calls you Catherine today. Should be used to it. Well, we have a good show. We have our first guest, or our only guest, here today live in studio. But before we get to that, if you want to call in at all, number here is 617-627-3800. Also on Twitter at Boxman37. And Kathleen, do you use Twitter? Are you active? Can people reach you?
I have a Twitter. You can use it. I don't know if I'll respond to you because I don't really use Twitter. But it's Kathleen Dale, D-A-Y-L-E.
There you go. So feel free to hit us up at any time. We are back as usual on Saturday mornings for an hour of nutrition, food, and fitness talk. And before we get to our guest, I'm going to have Kathleen kind of recap something we've talked about over the past couple of weeks in bits and pieces, and that is the article about millennials and is the food movement fake or not. And just to recap where we stand, Kathleen's going to tell you a little story about how her interpretation of that article.
Yeah, so Eve Turow-Paul, she's a great writer, and she wrote an article in Medium.com about how millennials are faking the food movement, and there was some good points in her article. She pointed out that like we're more about like Instagramming and like sharing cookie recipes. And I took issue with that because I call myself a millennial. Matt, I know you don't like that term and you don't refer to yourself as one. But I know a lot of millennials, people my age, even if they don't call themselves millennials, who are doing really positive things in the food system, and I responded with some examples.
Yep. And one of your examples, right, is here with us.
Yeah, his name is Ross.
So we have Ross Richmond here.
Good morning.
He is from Food for Free, the Somerville Backpack Program. And the what's the new name of the program that you're also working on?
Food for Free, we're doing the Family Meals.
Family Meals.
Family Meals Program.
So excellent. Thank you for being here this morning.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
To talk about your work. And so full disclosure, Kathleen and I actually worked with Ross last semester during our time at Friedman. Helping out to get the Family Meals program started. So, Ross, why don't you take it away and kind of tell us a little bit about yourself and the program that's going on.
Yeah. So, again, my name is Ross, and I'm the Community Partnership Manager at Food for Free. And what we are is a food rescue organization and a hunger relief organization. Like you were saying, the program that you were working on is a fairly recent program that we started at Food for Free in the past couple of years. We began collecting food that was donated from dining halls. We started at Harvard University. We're now at Tufts collecting food that is perfectly fine. You know, when you have a hot bar, you walk in a dining hall, there's a lot of abundance there, mm-hmm. and always is going to be a little extra that's uneaten but not touched. And so we're taking that food and receiving that from donor agencies like Tufts University, bringing it back to our headquarters in Central Square and distributing it into the emergency food system for folks in need.
Excellent. And who can you talk about a little bit about the demographic for the Family Meals Program in terms of who's receiving those meals right now?
Yeah, yeah. So as you were saying, when we first started working last fall, we started piloting by working with some Somerville students who were really high need, whether, you know, there was an electrical fire that caused them to have to leave their home temporarily, or maybe they just showed up from another country, folks in crisis. And so what we did was we kind of started asking around and asking students what kind of food you want, what kind of meals would be helpful. And it really turned out that for folks in crisis, they needed a meal that was quick, easy, nutritious, and that looked appealing because they're kids, so they're pretty harsh critics. So we did a lot of taste testing and making sure that the food worked for the students. But it worked for older students, like Tufts University students, and it was really good to see that the students in the Somerville Public Schools liked the meals as well. We're working with an after-school program and doing some taste testing there. And we started packaging the meals into microwavable containers, sealing them up, and getting them to students. That then became, that was the basis of the Family Meals Program that Food for Free now does.
Cool. And yeah, some people may think, oh, it's, you know, leftover food that these people are getting. But no, this is the meals are legit. Like Ross said, we got to try them as well. Like these are good quality meals, healthy meals, so which is great, increasing food access and healthy food access at the same time. So, you know, we go to Freeman a lot of there, you know, there's a lot of science-based stuff going on there, and a lot of studies are done typically with adults, focus groups and things like that. So what was it like working with kids and doing taste tests and soliciting feedback from them?
So honest. They were like, we gave them all these surveys to say, like, you know, what could we add here, what could we do to make this better, and they'd be like, it's outrageous you don't have stuffing on the turkey, and you know, like more salt and pepper, and some cultural things that were being talked about too amongst the students. There's a really high immigrant population in Somerville Public Schools, and we loved all of it, and that's why we really focused on kids. One, because they're really important to target. If you know, if they're not getting the nutrition they need, it's really going to show up in the school and in their performance. But yeah, so it was a lot of fun. I know working with the Tufts, with your group, we went in and just, it was kind of like a lot of wrangling and a lot of making sure, you know, that it's students, so making sure they cooperate a little bit, but they were coming back for seconds and really giving us a lot of good pointers that is now really incorporated into the program.
Awesome.
Can you talk a little bit about some challenges working with donated food? Like, I know I can imagine that listeners might think like, like, is it safe to eat? Like, how do you keep it from going bad? What's your liability?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, so first, the liability question is a really big one. In 1990-something, Bill Clinton signed the Good Samaritan Act, which basically indemnified anyone from donating food and the liability around that. So as long as in good faith you're donating food in a safe way to the best of your ability, then you're not going to be liable for if someone got sick, for example. It basically was a lot of companies or a lot of organizations were afraid to donate to hunger relief organizations because they didn't want to be sued by someone who got sick from their food, even if there was no fault of their own. Maybe something happened during travel or the food was left out or what have you. And that was a big barrier. So that was a federal mandate or a federal law that was passed. So there's not much liability. No one has ever been sued under the Good Samaritan Act for getting someone sick by doing something in good faith to feed folks. But people still think there is a liability around it. So there's a lot of education, and that's one of the big challenges we have at Food for Free, is making sure that folks know that, you know, this is a partnership, and we're really here to protect each other and make sure that no one gets safe, and our practices are very solid. So that's that one piece. And then what was that second part? Oh, the actual food, huh?
keeping it safe. Yeah,
yeah. Yeah, keeping it safe. So it's tricky. Yeah. So the food we get from Tufts Dining Hall is, it's frozen, and that really helps us with.
So they freeze it before.
Exactly. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the Tufts Dining folks do that, and there's some student groups that are working to help package the food as well, into a, like a, basically bags that are able to donate to us at Food for Free, and so yeah, so there's a lot of tricky things that come with frozen food. It's you know, it's hard, it's in a big bag, it's bulk, and so a lot of what we do and kind of the value added piece that Food for Free brings is breaking that food down into individual containers that can be consumed by actual folks who need it.
Sure.
Nice. Yeah.
And so you talked about the Good Samaritan Act, and I don't know if you saw the John Oliver video that on food waste. And
yeah, that one was great.
Yeah, it's a really good one. I recommend that you check
was
it out.
Last summer, I think.
I think in June or July, and it's on YouTube. You can check it out. But one of the things he shows is they're asking an employee at a grocery store about, you know, all this food is being wasted. Like, why don't you donate it? And the guy says, "Oh, well, we can make somebody sick and liable." So it's true that a lot of people know this, and yeah, the word has to get out there. So how do you, in your opinion, how do you get the word out there about like that? I mean, is it one you just approach potential donors, it gets brought up, or is it, you know, how do you convey that? I'm just communications and
right. I think it's really a group effort. So we're not the only organization out there talking about rescuing food. Obama just recently talked about limiting food waste. In Massachusetts, we passed a ban on throwing out organic waste. It, you know, needs to be composted if you have a certain amount of it, if you're a business. And so there's a lot of people who are saying this is a really good way to decrease the amount of waste that goes into a landfill, but also trying to reframe the conversation to say this isn't waste, this is actually really good edible food. It's just, you know, within the certain time frame that it's out at Whole Foods at the Hot Bar, for example, when it goes back, it's still really good food. So I think kind of at every part along the chain, folks are talking about the ways that it can be donated or still consumed. And so it's kind of like a effort from all of the government, the nonprofit, the private sector.
Great. And just to put this in context, some people may not be totally clear on what food waste is. Like I said, a lot of times it's perfectly edible food. So in the U.S. currently, it's estimated that about 40% of food produced is wasted each year, which equates to about 37 million tons of food waste annually. And a large portion of that waste comes from consumers. Hmm. So they purchase food and they don't use it and they wind up throwing it away, or it's leftovers that don't get eaten. In fact, it's estimated that Americans wasted 1/3 of all produce purchased. And there's a ton of other stats you can look up on this. It's pretty staggering when you hear about exactly how much food is going to waste. So what about food rescue interested you, Ross? Like, how did you get involved with this in the first place? What was your back? Did you have a background in nutrition or in social justice, or where did this all come from?
Yeah, let's think. It was kind of a roundabout way. I was working at the State House, so I was in politics and knew about some of the stuff going on around food waste because we were passing the bill about 2 years ago or so is when it was being crafted, this food waste ban bill. About composting. But really, I got involved with Food for Free after starting the Somerville Backpack Program, where we're feeding students on the weekend who don't have access to food on the weekends that they rely on during the weekday. You know, you go, you get free breakfast, you get free lunch, and then on the weekend, it's kind of like, good luck, but mm-hmm. you're still expected to be a student. So through that program, I was connected with Food for Free, who was donating apples and oranges and applesauce, some snacks, to the Cambridge Weekend Backpack Program, who was around a year or two before I was in Somerville. And after working with them for a while, we kind of got into a conversation about this potential of the prepared food that was kind of coming online, so to speak, in the hunger relief and food rescue world. So we got connected, and I left my job at the State House. I was doing political communications at the time. So kind of a drastic jump. But I was in that space of hunger in Somerville. And since then, I've been exploring and learning and really kind of figuring out how to best get this food, which is really kind of hard to understate how valuable it is. Putting really amazing proteins and fresh mm-hmm. you know, prepared food into the emergency food system for folks to access beyond, you know, what you think of traditionally like canned goods and stuff that's not as healthy. So it was very exciting to have this really great product and try to figure out what to do with it. And then, you know, that excitement kind of rippled, and that's when I was connected with you all yep. and Tufts University, and I said, this is really exciting, but we got to figure out how to get this to families, and that's when the ideas for packaging and distribution started to form.
Does Food for Free keep track of how many pounds of food, like a week or a year, that it collects from donors, and how many meals go out each week?
Yeah, we do. We have, you know, Salesforce that keeps all of our data, so I don't have to keep it in my head, which is nice. the number of meals we're putting out right now is something around 400 to 500 a week, and that goes primarily to folks that are in a motel right now at ABCD. They're ABCD clients, and that's at the Days Hotel in Alston Brighton.
Sorry, can you say what ABCD
is? Yeah, it's the Action for Boston. Oh, geez, it's a CDC, and they're the big, all these acronyms.
All right,
just
that's kinda, cool.
Yeah, you just get used to them. Action Boston Community Development, something like that. And they're one of the biggest service providers in Boston. And we're working with them. It's a program, and Boston Healthcare for the Homeless, and it's an Alston Brighton Health Collaborative, and basically we're collaborating to feed folks who are homeless who are living in motels and providing them these meals that they can put in the microwave, because that's all they really have to cook with in a motel. And they're the folks who are the overflow system from the shelter. When the shelters are full, the state puts families up in hotels. So
these are mostly families, like a parent and a child.
Yeah,
or children.
A single mother mostly.
Okay.
And so meals are going there. They're also going to students in Cambridge Public Schools who are in need, and Somerville Public Schools, on an emergency basis. So yeah.
It's great.
And so you mentioned that you got connected to us through Tufts. And so for people wondering about that, that was through the course Food Justice taught here on Medford campus. It's actually part of the UEP program, which, Kathleen, you're actually you're a UEP as well,
yeah,
right?
I'm a UEP dual degree with Friedman Agriculture, Food, and Environment. But I haven't had too many UEP classes just yet. I'm going to be starting in the fall.
And what does that stand for again? Speaking of acronyms.
yeah, right. Urban and Environmental Policy and Planning. It's a mouthful,
yeah.
Which is why I just say UEP.
Oh, yeah, I think everyone does. Much easier. So, yeah, current students who are interested in that can check it out. I believe it is being offered again in the fall. So it's a great way to get to learn about social justice in the food system and also get connected to organizations like Food for Free. So, Ross, for people who are interested in this sort of thing, you know, especially whether they're going to school for nutrition or social justice or anything like that, sort of what advice do you have for people who want to get involved with this, with food access and food justice in general? Because it's not like you can go on necessarily to, Monster, and there's going to be a nonprofit advertising saying, hey, we're doing this, come work for us. So what do you recommend for students who want to get involved in this line of work?
Yeah, great question. Well, Boston's a pretty exciting place right now to be involved in this work. So if you're interested, there's a lot of avenues to check out, much more than just going on Idealist and scrolling mm-hmm. down through the list and saying, you know, like, okay, what do the jobs look like here? Sometimes they're, you know, they're not there, like you're saying, because it's kind of a community that's a lot of different veins. So there's a lot of opportunity depending on what your interest is, what your skills are, how you want to be involved. There's a lot of work going on with conferences, too, that are a really great way to kind of get a feel for the space. And so there was just a Food Better conference at Harvard this past week. There's one coming up in the summer. Tufts University has several, I know, ways to get involved in that way with conferences that are coming up as well. I definitely recommend starting to get on some of those listservs, mm-hmm. and I'm smiling because Matt and I were just talking about that the other day about where to find some of this stuff. But there's a lot out there once you get connected to it, and it just kind of starts to snowball. So I think, you know, going on UEP and kind of like starting to Google and getting some of the what's this one organization in Boston doing something, and then at that website they'll tell you something else, and so it's really quite connected. So other advice?
What about volunteer opportunities?
Yeah, I was going to say, like, just there's so many ways to volunteer too. Obviously, volunteer at Food for Free, of course. We have a website, so you can do that. That's very simple.
Foodforfree.org if you want more info.
Yes, exactly. There's a lot of ways to get involved. You know, just going down to Daily Table and checking it out, which is in Dorchester, and they're doing kind of a food rescue, food security supermarket. And there's a lot of innovative spaces that are going on in Boston. So once you kind of get connected to one, you ask around and you hear about others. I wish there was kind of this, like, here's your packet that tells you all about what's going on in the space. But of course, that's not how it works.
Awesome. Well, thank you very much for coming on. Are you going to stick around, Ross, or do you have to head out?
I got to head out.
Okay. Yeah. No problem. But yeah, again, if you want more info, foodforfree.org, and learn more about what they're doing. Also, on Facebook, you can also check out the Somerville Backpack Program for more info. And
I was going to say, yeah, and a great way to just, you know, go on the Food for Free website, but if there's any other questions, to go on the Food for Free Facebook page, mm-hmm. shoot us a message. That goes right to my phone. I get all these little alerts from all these people with different questions. So definitely do that if you're interested. It's quick and kind of easy, and it doesn't take too much effort. So.
Cool. And then just a completely unrelated note. So Kathleen, you actually have some previous radio experience, and Ross, you're a big fan of the medium.
Yes.
So why so?
For the radio?
Yeah.
I like listening a lot. Like, that's a really evocative way for me to experience something. So, like, I wash the dishes. We don't have a dishwasher in my house, and I always put on Planet Money podcast or, some other... A whole bunch of, you know, the new NPR One app always makes me click around and find new things. But it's just a great, I don't know, it kind of hits me. Like, that's the time where I can actually, like, cry mostly when I listen to the radio, as opposed to movies. You know, everyone's got their thing, and that's just the one to
you cry when you listen to podcasts.
Well, like, if it's a really good story, you know what I mean? Like, you get a good Moth podcast on there, yeah. And someone's telling a story, and it's just like.
Didn't we talk about, like, a really deep Snap Judgment podcast once?
I think we did.
Yeah, that you said made you cry?
Yeah, well, yeah, there's several. It's like terrible, like, but I love it, you know? It just hits you. I think it's, you know, you paint your own picture. It's like reading a book, but not reading a book, you know what I mean?
You can be doing other things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially when I drive. Oh, man, it'll get me. It'll be like a nice, beautiful morning, good whatever story on the radio, and it's like, that's it. I'm done.
Just waterworks.
Yeah.
All right, well, awesome. Thank you very much for getting up and joining us.
One more question.
Go ahead.
Before you leave, do you self-identify as a millennial?
Oh, yes. We should ask you about the whole thing. Where do you stand on that debate?
Yeah, so Kathleen and I were going back and forth over text, just like debating this out when she was preparing for the story that she's writing. And so, I guess I am, right? Like, so I'm 27.
Yeah.
I'm turning 28 in the fall, right? So that's like, by definition, a millennial. But I think it makes me sound so young to be like, as a millennial, it always makes me think. I always think of someone a little bit younger, or someone who's in college, just kind of coming of age.
The negative connotations with the word.
Yeah, it's a little bit. But why is it? You know, why is it pejorative?
I think older generations just like to hate on us.
Yeah, maybe that's it. But like, yeah. So no and yes. Like, it doesn't scare me that much, but it doesn't feel like it really captures. I also think it brings up a certain type of person. When you think of millennial, oftentimes you think of kind of like privileged folks with agency who might be college graduates who are like out there fighting for something.
Sure, but then it can't be generalized across a whole generation.
Right, exactly.
Which it is.
So I think, you know, it's a little problematic in that way perhaps, but that might just be my interpretation of it. I think it's thrown around a lot with, as kind of like this buzzword that's like, oh, millennials think this, and you're like, whoa, slow down, like, who thinks what? Let's really get into the perspective we're trying to, you know, talk about here. And
thanks for answering that question. I think I just like to hate on the haters, so
including me.
Yeah.
All right. Well, any other questions? Anything else you want to bring up, Ross? Or?
Good.
No, it's been fun.
All right. Awesome. It has been. So again, thank you for joining us. To recap, foodforfree.org. Also check them out on Facebook, as well as Somerville Backpack Program for more information if you want to volunteer, donate, get more involved, what have you. So we're going to play a song. This is Kathleen's choice for the week. Kathleen, do you want to intro this real quick?
Yeah, this band is called Half Moon Run. I first saw them in Ohio a couple years ago. They were really good. I'd never heard of them before that. They are from Montreal. I'm also from Canada, although the western side. But I had to plug that. This song is called Full Circle.
All right, and you're listening to it on an Unbalanced Breakfast, WMFO, in Medford 91.5 FM, streaming live on WMFO.org.
Your hand turns full circle. I'm hopeless with no coffee and a medical text. It's too easy knowing nothing, blowing off the rest. And the riddles in the pages leave it too much to guess. And the worry cracks and fracture from your hip to your chest as I watch. It's your hand turns full circle.
Duncan, get over here. Need you to stay with me and your brother, okay?
I am.
Well, closer. Come on. Help me out here, buddy. Excuse me. Duncan, you're blocking me out.
I want some bologna.
Not today.
I want it.
Sorry. Duncan.
I want to put the number thing.
Too bad.
Mommy would let me.
Yeah, well, she's not here, okay? She's gone, and... She's not coming back, and you're just gonna have to deal with it like the rest of us, okay? Duncan.
On May 29th, Michelle Jimenez was killed by a drunk driver. She left behind her husband and four children. Drinking and driving is a crime that kills abruptly, but the pain lasts forever. Friends don't let friends drive drunk. A message from the U.S. Department of Transportation, the National Association of Broadcasters, and the Ad Council.
All right, welcome back to An Unbalanced Breakfast here on WMFO Medford 91.5 FM, streaming live on WMFO.org. So we're going to transition now out. So our guest, thank you again, Ross, for joining us. He has since left, but you can join us if you'd like. The number here is 617-627-3800. Chime in on what we talked about for the first half of the show or anything else. And now...
Before we say anything more, I just want to point out that Half Moon Run is going to be in Boston on May 9th.
Excellent. Do you remember where?
Is it the Brighton Music Hall?
Brighton Music Hall.
Yeah.
Yes. Awesome venue.
And that's the night before my econ final. And I want to go anyway.
That's, I mean, well, two things at Brighton Music Hall. That's where I saw Lara Jane Grace, and that'll be relevant in a little while. And then, I mean, I went to a Red Sox Rays game the night before my econ final, same class, and it all worked out very well. So definitely do it. You'll
good,
be good.
Good.
It's good luck. All right. So Catherine's not here, and she, like we always talk about, she is much deeper into the science world than I am. Kathleen, you're actually my same concentration, AFE. So again, a little bit lighter on the science, but we are going to talk a little bit about a scientific issue right now, and that is GMO salmon, which we've talked about a few times on this show, but we're going to get a little bit deeper into it right now. So why don't you take it away? What is GMO salmon, Kathleen?
Sure, yeah. So the company that developed GE or GM salmon is called Aqua Bounty Technologies, and they're actually located here in Waltham, Michigan, Massachusetts. I used to live in Michigan, so that just slipped out, sorry. They started the approval process with the FDA more than 20 years ago. I think it was like 1993. And only in, I believe it was November, they got approval from, this last November, approval for human consumption. And this is important because it's the first genetically engineered animal approved for human consumption. We've already been eating GM plants for some time, but this kind of sets a precedent, so it's kind of important. And what they do is, so the way genetic engineering works is they basically introduce a desirable trait into an organism by combining pieces of DNA. And I'm not a scientist, I'm not gonna incorrectly tell you how that works, but they do it to express certain genes that will lead to these traits that are desirable, whether it's nutritionally or something about the production. So GM salmon is genetically modified for production purposes. They take a gene for a gene from Chinook salmon, and they combine it with a gene from an ocean pout, which is like an eel, and they insert it into an Atlantic salmon, and it actually, the fish grows in half the time, so the production time is just faster.
So these are salmon that already exist, that are being enhanced?
They exist, they're not on the market yet, because they've been approved by the FDA, but kind of a loophole is that they have to be... The eggs are started in Prince Edward Island, mm-hmm. and then those eggs are transported down to Panama, where they're farmed in tanks. They're all like, it's a terrestrial facility. It's not near the ocean because they set that up purposely for protecting the environment. They don't want any salmon to escape and then interfere with mm-hmm. the wild ecosystem. The loophole is that Congress recently disallowed the import of GE salmon until they can publish final guidelines about how to label GE salmon. So it's not being sold here yet.
Mm-hmm. So because this is an American, it's funny because it's an American-based company, but because they're making it outside the U.S., you could get kind of this loophole bill to ban imports. That way it's not necessarily banning the production of the salmon, but it's can't be in the country.
Yeah, right. So that's pretty interesting. So lots of food retailers have already claimed that they, or stated that they won't sell Aqua Advantage salmon. That's what it's called. That's the trade name, I guess. So those include like Trader Joe's, Kroger, Aldi, Target, Safeway, Costco, Whole Foods, Meijer, if you are familiar with Meijer in Michigan.
Yeah, and if you're not, if you've been watching, or if you were watching playoff hockey and wondering what the heck Meijer was on the Red Wings rink, it is a grocery store, which I found out this week from Kathleen.
Yeah, it's a pretty well-known one in Michigan.
So now, why are retailers banning this? Because, you know, is it just to, you know, do they really care about the science here and the FDA process? Is it because, is it to appease pushback for consumers? What's your sense?
I think there is, there's just a fear of genetically modified food, and I think they're anticipating that customers won't want it.
Mm-hmm.
And so it makes them look good, like they're standing up for what consumers want and think is safe. The FDA found that Aqua Advantage salmon is substantially equivalent to wild salmon, or farmed salmon rather, which is how they can pass accept it for human consumption without labeling it. But there have been a lot of protests against having it not labeled, because you won't be able to tell the difference. You don't know what you're buying. I think people just want to know what they're buying.
And yeah, that goes into the whole labeling debate in terms of, you know, the right to know versus, you know, there's nothing proven that's harmful about GMOs right now. So that's one argument against labeling. That's like, well, what's the point? It's going to unfairly stigmatize us. And I think it's kind of, I think it is kind of an odd way. It's like a highly visible way to, you know, maybe pander to these consumers who are doubtful about it. But at the same time, if you were to, you know, like, why are they picking this fish? If they were to be like, okay, they're taking a stand against one thing when they're selling, it's over 50% of products contain GMOs.
Right.
So if you were to be like, yeah, we're not going to sell any GMOs, we're going to have to clear out half our shelves. So like, you know, why this specific product? Is it because it's an animal? It's going to be the first one? Or
I mean,
is it
maybe,
just because are they riding
is.
This current uproar about GMOs?
Maybe all of the above. I think it is kind of important that it's the first animal. People have this weird idea about like creating life, which, I don't know if you want to get into that, but it's weird. It's weird, and I get that. I get like we want to eat all natural, but if you really think about it, agriculture is not natural.
Mm-hmm.
The corn that we eat is not. It doesn't look like the corn that it came from.
I mean, the whole origin is disrupting the natural state of the planet, right?
Yeah.
That's what agriculture is.
Yeah.
Cultivation and all that. So, yeah. I mean, again, we've tended to avoid the whole labeling debate here. We've given you like the news and the facts and updates, but want to avoid that whole debate because you can argue it ad nauseum and nobody's going to get anywhere and everyone's just going to get mad and hate each other. Like most arguments in the nutrition space. So let me ask you this, and obviously there's a caveat to this question for you personally, but would you eat the GMO salmon?
Yeah, and the caveat is that I am vegetarian, so I don't normally partake of fish, but I have, and occasionally I still do if I am feeling bad. but I don't know. I'm kind of torn on this. I think it's probably safe, and it probably is nutritionally equivalent, substantially equivalent. Maybe.
Okay.
The thing is, I don't know if I would know that I was eating it because at present it doesn't. It's only required. It's not required to be labeled. It's voluntary labeling. So I don't know if there's really a way that we would be able to tell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's one of those things for me. I mean, I love salmon, and I would probably eat this almost no question, just because it's like, I don't know, same thing with the other GM products currently out there. There's been no harmful effects to humans. And I feel like there's so many other things wrong. Like we talked about the whole food waste thing with Ross. Other issues to worry about than what eating a bite of food is going to do to you in 30 years or something. And like we've talked about on the show, you don't consume these products and they instantly start morphing your DNA. Like that just does not happen.
Right.
So I'm interested to see where this goes. And I guess from a more ethical standpoint, this is not necessarily how it works, but if you were able to, you know, mass produce some GM fish product, which is arguably one of, if not the best source of protein for people, to increase access to it, do you think that's a good thing? Do you think that should be used, or do you think that how much is that?
I think I lean toward the side of it should be, because as Ross was saying, we all know that like protein is a really important, especially in developing countries. I think it's harder to get protein. I don't think it's a challenge in the US to get protein. Everybody can get enough protein.
We overconsume it technically, right?
I think in developing countries, it's maybe a little bit more important. So yeah. Now, whether salmon is the way to do that, because, you know, in any given culture, I don't know how important salmon is going to be in their food culture. We should probably find ways that are culturally appropriate to get people protein. But if fish is one avenue to do that, then I think, you know, I'm not entirely opposed to it. I'm a little torn on the GM issue, I think I'm more and more leaning toward it's probably okay, but they should probably be labeled.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I can see that. And although I'm for anything that could potentially reduce the price of sushi, that would be nice.
Right.
And so keeping on this idea of kind of altering existing foods, and since you brought up being a vegetarian, so do you want to tell us a little bit about the veggie burger that currently is out there that is modified to taste like real hamburger meat?
Yeah, I don't know if it's actually out there for purchase yet or if they're still trying to perfect it, but it's Impossible Foods' brainchild, and they have found a way to take heme iron, which is, I think it's found in blood, and it's what gives meat its flavor, and they've added it to a plant-based patty.
Mm-hmm.
And it's supposed to bleed like a real raw burger. And it's supposed to taste similar. I don't know what they have for texture. I know texture is a really big important piece of meat too. So I'm curious about this. I know a lot of people, I'm acquainted with a lot of vegans and vegetarians who would be like, ugh, I don't want my food to bleed. But I used to eat meat. And I get why meat is delicious. I don't crave it very often unless it's right in front of me and smells good, mm-hmm. which doesn't happen to me very often anymore because I never have meat at home. But where was I going with that?
It's like, yeah, so the question becomes, I mean, people are vegan or vegetarian for many different reasons. It could be health, could be choice, whether it be taste or ethics or nutrition. So do you think that, I mean, if you're a vegetarian, let's say it's by choice, because health reasons would be kind of, you'd have a different frame set or frame of mind. But, you know, if you're taking a stand against meat for whatever reason, then do you think it's, you know, I don't know if valid's the right word, but like, why would you then want to mimic what you're trying to avoid, whether it be fake bacon or these fake burgers or Moo-free, which you also wrote about for the Sprout, which is a non-dairy dairy, basically. Like,
yeah.
You know, what is your thought? You know, is it vegetarianism, veganism, don't want to conflate the two, but like, is it a lifestyle thing? Or is it more for practical purpose? I also equate it myself. Cause this is what my point of view is, like the straight edge movement, like you see in whether it be in music or other fields where, you know, no drugs, no drinking, but then those people drink coffee and soda, and it's like, well, if you don't want to have drugs, then why are you drinking caffeine? And then, you know, then it's like, well, it's supposed to be practical, or are you supposed to be hardcore 100% lifestyle? So what's your take on that?
So I think it's fine to take a hard stand and denounce eating meat as part of your lifestyle. I know a lot of vegans who don't think it's a diet, they think it's a lifestyle. And then that would include never buying leather, for example, or honey, even. But I think, like, we know that agriculture takes a big toll on the environment, especially animal agriculture. I think that would be my primary reason, and health, to be vegetarian. And I think, you know, we're starting to see even some, like, governmental agencies saying as much, talking about sustainability, talking about reducing the quantity of meat in your diet. And I think that should be, and hopefully is, the way that we're moving. But I also know how important food is in people's lives. And it's a cultural signifier. You can't just take something away and expect people to be okay with it. So I think being able to adequately mimic the flavor and taste of meat is going to be really important to people.
I can see that. And yeah, you'll definitely have to do a taste test if you can track down this burger whenever it's ready or served, and let us know how that, because I just think, like, I've tried to eat substitutes before, but and I found them absolutely disgusting anyway, so.
Depends on what brand you get.
Fair enough. All right, so we're going to take our second song break of the morning. Again, if you want to weigh in on that debate or food waste, anything that we've talked about so far, number here is 8, or I can never keep these numbers straight. Number here is 617-627-3800. Also active on Twitter, at Boxman37, or on our Facebook page, Unbalanced Breakfast Radio. And then this song kind of is how I feel about a lot of issues going on in the food movement right now. This is from the band Against Me, of which Laura Jane Grace is the main singer. I was a teenage air anarchist, and you're listening to An Unbalanced Breakfast on WMFO Medford 91.5 FM, streaming live on WMFO.org.
A teenage anarchist looking for revolution. I had the style, I had the ambition, read all the authors, I knew the rough slogans. There was a war, but the class war, I was ready to set the world on fire. I was a teenage anarchist looking for revolution.
And welcome back to An Unbalanced Breakfast here on WMFO Medford 91.5 FM, streaming live on WMFO.org. You just heard the song I Was a Teenage Anarchist by Against Me off their White Crosses album. So we have about 10 minutes left in the show, and gonna do a few quick hits with some news and other things going on that we wanted to touch on. So first, we're going to stick with agriculture for a second and talk about the Female Farmer Project and our opinions on that. So Kathleen, do you want to give a quick overview of what that is?
Yeah, this photographer, her name is Audra Mulkern, and she just started a project photographing kind of like life of female farmers. So she takes one female farmer at a time and just kind of explores what they do, what their work is. That's basically an overview.
So it's almost like a, do you think it's fair to call it like a Humans of New York for female farmers almost?
I don't know if I would call it that.
I mean, well, there's a picture and there's a story that goes along with it.
Okay, yeah.
This has kind of been a little bit of an ongoing thing. This discussion about kind of the changing face of the farmer and spotlighting that there's a growing, I mean, there's always been a female presence in farming and it's kind of increasing as we go. So she wants to bring attention to that, which I think is good. How do you feel about it?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, I studied photography in undergrad, so this like also appeals to me on just like a an artistic, like photographic level. But I think it's important to tell the story of women in farming. I know it has always been a thing, but traditionally, you know, your average farmer is like an aging white guy.
So we were talking about this because like, I mean, the demographic is aging, like that's indisputable. But I think it's a cool feature, but sometimes the way that it's framed by other outlets, I don't love. Huffington Post says when most people think of a farmer, they might envision an old McDonald type in a straw hat. But that, I mean, I don't. I've
what
never
do you
done
envision?
That. I mean, I don't. Well, I mean, I guess I have to say after going to school, you know, for about agriculture, I would have a different point of view anyway. But I don't know if I do have. One view of a farmer, but it's definitely not an old guy wearing a straw hat. I can tell you that. I just think that's like such a.
But do you think you would if you hadn't gone to Friedman?
No. I think it's just like such a stereotype that. No, I mean if you watch anything on the news or any documentaries or anything like that, it don't look like that. Even if they are older white
but
men.
I think like, that narrative is perpetrated like in the popular. Like
see,
we
I don't, I,
we also have family farms which. But, are right. Also like huge corporations, which started as small family
people
farms.
People think of that's right. I mean, when you hear family farm, you think it's like a nice little Midwestern family on their
yeah,
ranch.
Yeah, with an aging white man wearing a straw hat at the helm.
What was I going to say about that? I was going to make a point, but now. Oh yeah, no, I was going to say I think that the. Did you, I don't remember if you, I think it was a Super Bowl a few years ago. There was like a commercial narrated by Paul Harvey, I think, doing the speech about, I'm totally butchering this right now, but he's like doing a voiceover of a famous speech about farming. And it's like showing all these black and white images of farmers. And again, they're very romantic and idealistic, which necessarily isn't what farming looks like now. Like these wholesome family farms that we were just talking about.
Mm-hmm.
But I saw more of a backlash. It wasn't like necessarily imagery that they're using, but people were like, no, that's not what farms are. Farms are like these subsidy sucking corporate entities that should do something else. You know, like to me, that's more of a notion I would like to dispel about this. I think like a lot of the news, again, it's like it's almost like GMOs. People just hear a buzzword and they clue on to it. A lot of people hear about the farm bill. They have no idea what's in the farm bill, but they hear about people complaining about subsidies and farmers getting. Even if they can't sell anything, like they're getting free money from the government for doing what they're doing, and people get fired up. So, in a sense, I think like I would like to see a feature kind of arguing against that.
Okay, don't you think she kind of does though? Like she's focusing on these women aren't corporations.
Mm-hmm.
Like she is kind of railing against that by uplifting them over corporations.
That's fair, and I do like the. I mean, I do think it's a good. I'm not saying that she shouldn't be doing this. I think it's awesome that she is doing this. I just thought, like the way other media is portraying it, I think it's a little too cliched.
Sure.
That's. I guess that's what I'm trying to say.
Yeah. Okay.
But you can check out this feature at audramulkern.com, AudraMulkern.com. Then she has a link to the Female Farmer Project. Definitely cool to check out. And I mean, I guess, yeah, at the very least, it's getting people to think about farming in a different way. And then let's kind of switching gears here since we don't have too much time, but we wanted to touch on a few different things. Grocery store. So you talked about Meijer, right? From your home state, Michigan.
Meijer.
And there was a survey that just came out, and Wegmans is now America's favorite grocery chain, which has overtaken Trader Joe's. And you had a take when you got to Massachusetts about grocery stores in general.
So I was surprised at how many grocery stores there are here, like regional chains, I guess. Maybe some of them aren't regional chains. They're just not in Michigan where I'm from. But we had like three main ones that we went to, and they were Meijer and Martin's and Harding's. And Harding's hardly ever went to. But anyway, there are so many here. I feel like every week we go to a different place. There's Hannaford and Shaw's and Star and Roche Brothers and Wegmans and Whole Foods and Trader Joe's. Like, I could keep Stop and Shop. I could keep going and going and going. And I was just like surprised. I feel like grocery shopping is a huge inconvenience here.
Really? Why?
Because
we don't have like enough stuff at the stores, or because?
I guess because we were really spoiled at Meijer. We could go there and get everything that we needed, and it was pretty affordable. And here, I feel like we go to like at least four different places on a regular basis, whether it's because like certain products that we like can only be found at one, or they're a lot cheaper at another one. I also find it really inconvenient that they don't sell alcohol in the grocery stores, in most grocery stores here.
See, for me, it was a surprise that there are grocery stores that do sell alcohol. Because it's funny that you talk about this perspective, because growing up locally here, to me, it was like you either go to Stop and Shop or a whole variety of companies that are basically have been folded up into Shaw's now. So, and then I feel like it's almost a more recent thing where you have this exposure, like you have Trader Joe's and Market Basket and all these places. And it is a chore to get to these, you know, America's most favorite. I mean, we have a new Wegmans now. I don't remember where it is, but it is inconvenient if you want to go to that, if you want that brand name. I don't know, maybe it's a millennial thing and you want to, you know, you have to get your certain foods here at Whole Foods and certain things here at Wegmans. But yeah, I guess it is kind of crazy, and just how many there are at this point.
It might have a lot to do with, I feel like getting around Massachusetts is a pain too.
So, well, hey, let me ask you this, because where you lived growing up, because I know that it's also different, even within Massachusetts. I used to live in the central part of the state, and you did have to make, if I didn't make an appointment to go to the grocery store before or after work, then I would have to drive 15 minutes to, you know, get gas and go to a grocery store and things like that. So, in terms of access, did you have to like make a special trip to go to the grocery store and get everything there, or was it more like in Boston where you can walk different places and go to five different stores?
Yeah, I mean, we did make a special trip, but it wasn't difficult to get to. I don't really know what you're asking.
Like, I mean, because so for me, I mean, okay, for context, like growing up in the suburbs, it's like less than, it could be a 5-minute drive or shorter. You know, you don't have to make a special trip, like it was just part of your routine. Whereas in other places, other more rural areas, like say it's much further, and you have to look more, and you do want to make the most out of that one trip.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's not different here. We have a Shaw's really close to us, and that's what we go to most often. But it's just, for me, it's just the inconvenience of going to multiple places, having to go to a whole separate like place to get a bottle of wine. Maybe it's, you know, first world problems, millennial problems.
Yeah, exactly. All right, so we are just about out of time. Is there any other topics that you wanted to touch on? I mean, this is you have been our guest host, and you...
Thanks for having me. This has been really fun.
Awesome, thanks for coming on. Anything you wanted to bring up in the last minute or so that we have here?
I don't know. We could breeze through a couple of the other topics, but...
One thing that people may have seen is that allegedly McDonald's was going to start piloting all-you-can-eat French fries at a restaurant in, I think, Mississippi. And people were getting all hot and bothered by that. And McDonald's has since denied that. Apparently, it's going to be a very temporary promotion at this one store. But you do not have to worry about, or you do not have to be excited about, depending on how you think, all-you-can-eat French fries coming to McDonald's near you. But interesting enough, they are going to be testing out two new versions of the Big Mac, I believe. One's like a Big Mac Jr. and one's like a Super Big Mac. So some people complain that just the current one is too small. Some people complain it's too big. So they're going to try these new sizes to appease everyone, because their business is floundering relatively. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're not going anywhere, but they have been losing customers.
I don't remember the last time I had a Big Mac.
Well, yeah, especially if you're vegetarian. maybe they'll come out with a vegetarian Big Mac for you.
Sure.
All right, so that wraps it up for this week. Thank you again to Kathleen for filling in very admirably for Catherine. Catherine should be back next week. We'll also have some members of the Freedmen Justice League as our guests. So until then, you can check us out again on Facebook and individually on Twitter. And any closing words, Kathleen?
Go and eat well. I don't know.
All right, have a great week. And Mike on the Mic is coming up next. See ya.
And laughter too. A scoop of kids to add the spice.
A dash of love to make it nice. And you got
too many cooks.
Too many cooks.
Too many cooks.
Too many cooks.